This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When Ishmael Bia was a young boy, he and his older brother, Junior, and their friends sang and danced. They loved music and performed in talent shows. Those carefree days, however, came to an end in 1993. That is when the two-year-old Sierra Leone Civil War entered their town. Bia, a boy of 12, was separated from his family. By 13, he was picked up by the army and turned into a soldier. Hundreds of thousands of child soldiers are fighting in more than 50 conflicts around the world. What are their lives like? How does a child become a killer? How does one stop? And how can the recruitment of child soldiers be stopped? Ishmael Bia, author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier, is our guest in this portion of the program. Bia came to the U.S. when he was 16 to speak to the U.N. He returned to the U.S. a year later. In 2004, he graduated from Oberlin College. Today, he is a member of the Children's Rights Division Advisory Committee of Human Rights Watch and is a frequent speaker on children affected by war. Ishmael Bia will participate in a panel discussion next month to talk about child soldiers. That event will be at the University of Illinois at Chicago on the evening of Thursday, May 3rd, 2007. It will be held in room 302 of the Student Center East at 6 p.m. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Ishmael Bia's book, A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Ishmael Bia, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm good.
Tell us about your family and your hometown in Sierra Leone before the war.
Well, I grew up, I had two brothers and a mother and father. I had a very small family, and, you know, I had grandmother, grandfathers, uncles, and aunts, and all of that stuff. But, you know, I had a very simple and remarkable life. I didn't have electricity or tap water, but I went to school. I learned Shakespeare. At the age of eight, I was introduced to American hip-hop. And I, you know, after school, I went swimming. I played soccer. I visited my grandmother in the village that was nearby. And I, spent time on the farm. I spent time listening to traditional storytelling. Oral tradition was very strong tradition in my culture. And so I listened to stories at night, and this is basically my life.
Yeah. Sounds like a good life.
It was very good. It was simple and very, very joyful as well.
Yeah. You knew a little about the war before it came to your town, but you say it seemed like it was happening in a faraway and different land. What did you know about the war that had begun in 1991?
Well, you know, there were lots of refugees who would come through my town, and they would, be carrying their sons and daughters and their children as they're generally walking through the town. And with bundles of clothes and things like that. And then, you know, when they would talk to the chiefs or talk to the elders of the town, people would convince them to stay. They said, no, we're going to keep walking because we think this war is going to reach it. And just the way their faces looked, you know, how, you know, skinny they were, malnourished, the children, and just how hollow their eyes looked. It seemed that they had seen something that was very difficult. And sometimes they told these stories about how the rebels had burned their villages, killed some of their families, and how they had been walking for, you know, months, and some of them had walked hundreds and hundreds of miles. But, you know, war wasn't my reality, so you couldn't really comprehend sort of this madness they were talking about.
Yeah. And the adults in your town, did they take any heed of these stories that they were hearing? Was there anything that could be done in preparation?
No, I think because we were still hearing about the war, but it almost like it was too far away. Because again, we grew up in a culture where there was a really deep care for people. Neighbors were like your families. The whole town knew everyone and mm-hmm. the child. So people could not really fathom or believe that what they were hearing was true. That other people could be that almost evil to their neighbors and things like that. They could commit the atrocities we're hearing they were committing to their neighbors. So I think people listened to it, but they had a difficult time understanding or believing it, you know?
Yeah.
And also people were very hopeful that perhaps it would not get here, you know, or perhaps it's something that would not last. It's just something that had shifted in that part of the country and that, you know, it would never be able to happen. In our towns, I think most people would believe that until it reached there now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's an adage in Sierra Leone, or at least in the part of the country where you were a boy. You learned this when you were a boy of six. Strive to be like the moon. Your grandmother explained what it meant to you when you were six. Would you tell the story?
The story is that... there's an old man who used to sit outside in Kabati, which is the village where my grandmother lived, and he always say, you know, we must always be like the moon, strive to be like the moon. And so I asked my grandmother what that meant, and she said, it's because when, you know, everyone complains when it rains, when the sun is out, when it's too hot, when it's too cold, but she said no one complains when the moon shines. Everyone appreciates the moon in their own different way. People will even just say, hey, here's the moon. It looks beautiful. Children will play on the slide. There was a lot of storytelling and dancing. And the reason why we should strive to be like the moon is so that our presence makes others comfortable, makes others at peace, just like the presence of the moon does not raise any it makes everyone comfortable in their own way. You know, they appreciate it. So that's why we should want to be like the moon.
Good advice. What's the situation in Sierra Leone today?
In Sierra Leone currently, there is the war ended in 2002, and so there is it's safe and everything, but I think they're still strong. I went there last year. The same political practices that caused the war are very present. Politicians went right back to doing the very same sort of embezzlement of funds and underhand things that really, when they were done to the max, gave rise to this war, gave rise for the need of something new to come along, and hence when the war came along, people thought that would be the solution. That turned out not to be. So that's very present. People don't have clean drinking water. There's no electricity. A lot of young people can't afford to go to school. Some of them have lost their family, so there's no one to look after them or pay for their schooling. And the government is not providing anything for them. So it's very sad to see that.
Yeah.
There's an election coming up in July, so hopefully whoever wins will have that country at heart and we'll be able to do something different.
Yeah. How are the children of Sierra Leone doing today? Talk a little bit more about that. What's their future, and how are they, those that have been orphaned, how are they surviving?
Well, it's very difficult how they survive. Some of them actually are having a very, very difficult time because they're just hanging about, feeling very useless or restless because there's nothing they can do with their lives at all, you know. So there's a lot of young people, who, especially those who are orphans, who are just in the capital and elsewhere in the country, who are just, they don't know what to do with their lives. And that is dangerous to have because, first of all, during the war, this is one of the problems. When children are hanging about like that, somebody can easily drag them into something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very dangerous to have that. So there are a lot of people. There are some who are finishing rehabilitation, who there are others who are fortunate to be able to go to school. But basically, people just are desperate because they really want to be able to do something with their lives. The war ended. That is a blessing. There's no more violence. But people need to start thinking about their future, and most people don't think or don't have the help they need to be able to start that. So that's really what the children of Sierra Leone are.
Yeah. Is rehabilitation available to to all the boys who are now grown who were soldiers?
It depends, you know. It's some of the boys who were grown, who were older, who perhaps were over 18 when the war ended. There hadn't been very much rehabilitation centers for them, because I think when these centers were created, they'd taken people who were under 18. But there are some people who had started the war when they were 15, and then they went over 18 because the war went on too long. And so that is a new problem that's actually been highlighted, and people are trying to fix that. Another problem is also there are lots of girls who, during the context of the war, during the time of the war, who were raped, and some of them had babies who were of these commanders, and some of these girls would not come forward to seek help because they're afraid of being stigmatized by culture, by being called, oh, this is the commander's wife, or things of that sort. So they hide. So there's also another kind of, there are a few people who are trying to set up organizations and NGOs that will go in and trying to look for these children and help them. So those are some of the things that are going on now.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction that there are hundreds of thousands of children who are soldiers fighting around the world. Is the situation by and large similar to what happened in Sierra Leone?
Yes. Basically, you know, in every country, it is very different why the civil war started, but the way children are recruited generally is the same. First of all, there's a strong sense of coercion, whereas, you know, if you don't join, you're killed, and then when you're brought into this war, you're drugged up, and then you're constantly traumatized, exposed to, you know, severe traumas, and then you lose yourself completely. So that is true for all places. Now, some places, there are children who come to these groups and join, which they call voluntarily. But the thing is, they don't join voluntarily because some of them come because there's nothing else that they can do. And if they stay home, their families will be killed. So some of them are forced to go into it as a way of protecting their families and things of that sort. So either way, it's some sort of coercion. Some of them are more heightened and more severe than others, but it's generally the same
thing. Yeah. You were... You got to a rehabilitation center thanks to UNICEF.
Yes.
Talk with us about UNICEF and its efforts to stop the practice of children being recruited to be, or for, recruited is not quite the right word,
forcefully recruited into this war. Well, UNICEF, United Nations, Human Rights Watch, there are several organizations that are doing this. But in Sierra Leone, one of the things that happened is that UNICEF, along with other UN affiliates and non-government organizations, went to Sierra Leone and started funding or creating local rehabilitation centers during the war, because they had become such a rampant use of children, you know, from all sides of the war, the army, which I was in, the RUF, and then the CDF. The RUF is a rebel group, Revolutionary United Front, and then the CDF, which is like a Kamajor civil militia group. So they, you know, they went in because this has become so rampant, and so children were being used everywhere. And they set up these rehabilitation centers, and they would go into the bushes and talk to these commanders and convince them to release a number of children at a time. They'll bring them to these rehabilitation centers. I happen to be one of those lucky ones who was brought there to, you know, undergo rehabilitation. But the reason why they're able to go into these bushes and do that is because they've also worked before that to put in place certain international legal standards that says you cannot recruit children, whether you're a rebel group, whether you're a government group, that there's absolutely no excuse for it, that children have to be over 18. Now there are certain governments who have not signed to this, so sometimes it becomes difficult. But the reason why they're able to go is because of this law. So they do a lot of work on the ground to create rehabilitation centers, but there's also a lot of work being done to strengthen these international legal standards, to get nations, those affected and those not affected, to pay attention to it, to strengthen it so that they'll be able to release these children and also find ways to prevent these wars from happening in the first place so that children are not dragged into it.
Yeah. Because even if you're not a child soldier and you're in a war-torn country, the situation is not good.
It's not good at all. Actually, just to talk about that a little bit, is that this definition of child soldier has also been broadened, not only to say child soldier is the child who carries a gun, but it's a child who is affected by war in whatever way, because there are children who are used not to engage in active combat, but to carry arms and ammunition. And they're exposed to this madness the same way somebody who carries a gun is. There are children who are orphaned because of this war, who have lost everything that's dear to them, and their families have been killed in front of them. They too need to be rehabilitated because they're traumatized. There are girls who are sexually abused and who are brought in as just to be used as cooks during the conflict. So the definition is expanded to kind of include all these kids so that there's more of a holistic care for children who are exposed to this source of madness.
Yeah. How is a child turned into a killer? What is that process like? What happened to you?
Well, what happened to me? Well, first of all, in order for you to turn a child into a killer, you destroy everything they know. So in my case, you know, my tradition, culture, the town, everything was burned down, and my family was killed, you know, mother, father, and two brothers. So when you do this to a child, first of all, they lose hope in themselves and don't know how to carry on. And at this time when this happened to me, I was 12. So, and I've been exposed to a lot already. And then when you do that, then, you know, the way I was recruited was, forcefully recruited, was that, you know, I was basically given no choice. It was either join or be killed. And the choice was to leave the village, or you be killed, or you have to join. And, but when you left, the rebels would also kill you, because they think if you've looked for safety amongst the soldiers, they would think of you as an enemy. So as a child, you find yourself in this really precarious position where there's nowhere you can go, and if you try to go anywhere, you'll be killed. And then you stay in this, and then they basically train you how to use the AK-47 and other guns for less than a week. Not very much effective training. Perfection came by actually being in the war, and most children didn't survive the first year of war because of this, because no one knew what they were doing, and also we were paralyzed by fear. This is the first time we've been exposed to this. And before we go out, too, we were fed drugs. You know, we're given all kinds of drugs, from your common marijuana, cocaine, alcohol, whatever, pills, amphetamines of different kinds, and to kind of numb you from everything that you're feeling. So there's a constant kind of play of this. And there are exhibition killings when children are brought in order to desensitize them or to indoctrinate them. They make them kill people, or sometimes they make them witness the killing of other people. And this is the life. You know, you go out, you fight, whatever your commander wants to do. You come, you do drugs, you watch war films like Rambo, and then you go out, you fight again. There's no time to sit, to think, or to be in it. So as time goes on, with the drugs and everything, you take drugs and everything, you lose the ability to exhibit all those human emotions that you had once been able to exhibit. You become just this empty vessel. You lose yourself completely, and this becomes your reality, and you're in it fully. This is how you turn a child into a killer.
When did you realize that boys such as yourself were being forced to become soldiers?
Early on in the war, during the beginning of the war, when I was running from it, this was a few months after I started running from it, in 1993, and it's because the area first really started the practice, which is the rebel group, and then everyone else started doing it. And the reason how we found out about this is because, you know, we had been trying to go back to Matrujong, which is the town we were in before, to look for food, and some young men had put us under gunpoint and brought us to this town. And so we seen that there was young people. But also, when we were running from the war, first with my brother and then with other groups of kids, we're always, when we came to certain villages, militant civilians ran after us to kill us and things like that. It's because, there were these children who had been forcefully recruited by the RAF were actually, in order to bring them to this group, they asked to kill their own families, destroy their own towns and villages. So everyone knew about this thing. So when we came as young people, everyone feared us and everyone ran after us and tried to harm us. So I was very aware of this, which is why we kept running from this war, because we didn't want to fall in the hands of any of these groups who came in and attacked these towns. But
yeah. Well, when you began running, you were with boys, and then for a while you were alone, and then you were again with some boys. And each of those situations had its pros and cons. Being by yourself, it was very lonely, but If you were with a group of boys, you were very suspect.
Yep. That was a difficulty. You know, you can be alone or you can be with a group of boys where whichever time you came through, people arrested us. Sometimes they nearly killed us, and they gave us different punishments. But also being with a group of boys was the only way to be able to continue on, because you gave each other the courage, you gave each other the encouragement, you gave each other the support to be able to continue working. And one of the difficult things about that particular period was the uncertainty of not knowing what will happen tomorrow, what will happen the next day, when was this going to end. You know, all of these things were really difficult, and being in a group kind of made it, you know, made it bearable in a way, you know. So mm-hmm. You looked after each other. But that came with the disadvantage of being afraid of and being, you know, almost people coming at you to kill you all the time.
Yeah. In those fleeting moments of peace, did you wonder when the war would come to an end? Did you wonder what had happened to your family? Or were your thoughts really on the pressing issue of what's around the next corner? What do I do next?
Well, I did think of them. I did think of where they are, and I did think of, you know, who would survive and things like that, whether I'll be able to go back home. But, you know, we because of what we had grown up knowing, we didn't think this war would last that long. So we always hopeful that it was going to end fairly soon, but that didn't happen. So we always, I guess that's the only thing we could hold on to, the hope that it would stop at some point. So we did have that hope, and we did think about family, but we didn't try to dwell on it too much because the thought was too difficult, you know, to know what. So we tried to avoid that as much as possible. But even that, in terms of our individually, you know, we're always mentally fighting that, you know, trying to stay with what we were doing, trying to look for food and trying to continue running. But at the same time, you know, you had to hold on to the memories of family and things of that sort, and that was very difficult.
Yeah. Speaking of doing things that are difficult, how difficult was it to write this book?
It was very, very difficult, you know, on all sides, remembering the war. Because one thing, I wanted to write this book about how I felt then at that age and how I feel about it now. So that required for me to go there, smell it, feel it, and be in that world again. And it was very, very difficult. And also equally as difficult, it was when I wrote about the times before the war, because then I came to realize what I had really lost, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was really difficult and all. But what gave me the strength to sit down and write it is that each time I walk away from it, I thought that instant, you know, there was a child somewhere in the world where all these children were recruited who was going through that same experience. And that, you know, exposing it, writing about it was a small price to pay to do that.
Yeah. You know? Well, I want to thank you for writing the book and also for talking with us this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Ishmael Bia, the author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. You can join the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Were there places, before you became a soldier, were there places where the people welcomed you and where you had some downtime, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, there were places. I mean, even through this madness, you know, mm-hmm. I think that kindness that had been so much part of our culture was still present. People just really feared each other deeply because they didn't know who was who. But, you know, we arrived at certain villages where people were going hunting, and they would invite us to participate in that, and we'll spend the night, and they would cook us food. We had those moments. We had moments where people would you know, make us sleep on their verandas. You know, we had instances where, you know, at one point we had really been taken, our shoes had been taken from us, and we walked on this really hot boiling sand. And, you know, kind of our feet, under our feet had been really peeled and everything. And we had this young man who took care of us, brought us food and helped us to heal and things of that sort. So we had some kindness along the way. There are people who were really kind to us, but not as much as it used to be when things were normal, where everyone was kind to you.
Yeah. That to me was such a good part of the story. And also then when you were at the rehabilitation center, the people there, especially the nurse, Esther, and your American mom.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's what my life has been, basically, after that whole episode of my life. You know, I've met really remarkable, compassionate, and selfless people who have just been willing to you know, help me, you know, and to take care of me. And I think that in itself has helped really much to rekindle my own humanity and rekindle the joy I had known as a child, and to be able to live again in the second life and to fully appreciate it and be in it. You know, that's really what's been. I've just been extremely lucky to have that.
Yeah. How long were you a soldier?
I was for over 2 years.
And while you were a soldier, you saw horrible things. You killed people. You were also shot. And here again, you were remarkably lucky. You survived that.
I think I always, you know, I always say that, you know, to people that, you know, surviving that war, you know, had nothing to do with me knowing how to fight, being smart, or knowing how to run fast. It was pure luck and the grace of God, if you believe in God, and because the chances of dying were so much greater, but there were all these just little moments that of somebody being compassionate to me or somebody kind of extending a hand to me that really did help me out a lot, you know, like during the time during the war when I was shot, many times they could have just left me there, but decided to take care of me, even though it wasn't the most appropriate medical stand for this procedure, but still it helped me to be able to walk again today and to just be alive.
Yeah. Your wounds didn't mean the war was over for you either. Yeah.
Well, this madness, because everyone who was in that had lost themselves so dead that, you know, these things were not, as, you know, the gravity of them were not apparent to us because all of us were severely traumatized, drugged up. So, you know, after you're banded with these things, you go right back out, you know, after you've been able to limp around a little bit, you know. It was basically not, no one was himself. Even the adults and the commanders who were dragging us into this stuff, you know, had lost themselves severely in this madness. So we went right back into this madness, you know, and this had become our reality, and that's all we did.
Right. How do you begin to move toward another reality, to get out of that situation? Because when you were at the end of your time as a soldier, you were so into it.
Yes, I was, because one thing that happens also when you know, you're dragging to this, when I was dragging to this in the beginning, it was difficult, and then as time went on, with the drugs and with everything, you kind of have a sense of attachment to these groups. They become like your surrogate family because you've lost everything. The commander begins to look like, you know, your older brother or like your father figure. And so you have a strong sense of attachment, and you've lost all what makes you human in a way. And so, you know, when you're removed from this, there's a lot of undoing that has to happen. You know, basically, you have to undo all those things, the brainwashing, the trauma, the drugs, all of those things has to be undone. And so that's basically the process that went on at the rehabilitation center for me for 8 months. And after that was over, then I began to realize, you know, how, based on the people that were with me, how lucky I'd been, and also just I've gotten to understand really what violence does, what war really does to people, to the human spirit, what, you know, violence really is, that there's nothing romantic about it at all, as most people tend to think of it, because they've not been really truly touched by it. So from there on, I think, arises a very strong appreciation for life itself, you know, for each moment of being in it.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the process, about daily life at the rehabilitation center, and how people are able to come through this? How does it happen?
Well, for my part, you know, I think it's different for every center and the people who are there and what they decide to do. But for my part of it, in the beginning, the first 2 months was basically a withdrawal from the drugs, you know, just kind of cold turkey. We were just left and not given a chance to access any of these drugs at all. So basically, we couldn't sleep, you know, and there was a lot of kind of trembling, shaking, your body reacting, sweating, and things of that sort. And, you know, many nights spent sitting outside, finding yourself somewhere in the morning where you didn't know how you had gotten there and things of that sort. And then after the drugs were away, then the trauma started coming, because then you began to really remember all the things that had happened and how severe they had been, the things that had been forced to be a part of and how they were affecting you. And these memories came rushing. And then there was psychosocial therapy where, people try to talk to you about this and that it wasn't your fault and try to help you to discuss it. There was a reluctance to that as well. But people persevered and continued, and then there was a lot of sports that descended to engage you so that we could not sit and think about these things too much without them being somebody being there to control it. And so there was a lot of sports. And then after that, the trauma side of it, there was some preliminary schooling at the center where people learned certain things, you know, like we went to school for a little bit, some people did some vocational stuff and things of that sort. And then this goes on and on, repetitively, you go to different therapy sessions and things like that. And that's basically how it went.
Yeah. And also the support and kindness is shown by the people who are the adults.
Yeah, the people who are the adults who were there also who, you know, were able to just be there for us, you know. And when we needed them, and sometimes we, you know, the center was so really horrible to the people there, we would, you know, when we were not ourselves, we would stab people in the foot and arm or throw hot tea on their faces, and they would go to the hospital. When they returned, they would say, oh, it wasn't your fault, you know, you'll be fine, you'll regain yourself, and have you eaten any food? Can we get you something? Like, you know, in the beginning, those things really did upset us. But as time went on, we began to see that these are people that really cared for us. And one thing that I have lost, and one thing that we all had lost as children, was that we had come to distrust human beings. Mm-hmm. And we've come to distrust adults, especially because, you know, our families have been killed, and we have been dragged into this, and we had come to believe in it. We had been deceived so many times by adults, you know. So it took a while for us to believe that there were people who would care for you deeply and selflessly without wanting anything more, without wanting to do. So it took a while, and these people at the center just did everything to show that to us over and over again.
Yeah, and I mentioned Esther. She was...
Particularly, yes. And one thing that the Rehabilitation Center is that each child found one particular adult that they really became close with, and mine was Esther, and that's... adult really helped that child out to regain himself.
Yeah. At the beginning, though, you were reluctant to tell her your name.
Yes, I was reluctant to tell her my name and everything because, again, you know, when you're coming from this war, when you're being conditioned to believe in certain things, we'll come to believe that as combatants, we're responsible for determining what happens to adults and whatever, you know, we wanted their face to be, and all of a sudden you're in a place where there are adults telling you what to do. It's really upsetting. So there was a lot of reluctance coming from that. And again, this was just a process of undoing all of those brainwash that we had received.
Yeah. They weren't adults, they were civilians.
They were civilians. That's what we've come to believe. You know, they're civilians, and therefore they should not talk to any combatants and things of that sort. As we've been told many, many times, we've been drawn into us so much under drugs and under duress, so we've come to believe it so much.
Yeah. How was it that you found yourself as a candidate to go to New York to talk to the UN with other children from around the world?
After I finished rehabilitation, you know, I was put up with my uncle in the capital city who I live for a bit. And then, you know, this opportunity came for people to come and speak at the UN about what was going on in Sierra Leone. So I went to the interview, actually, which one of the field agents, Leslie, had kind of brought the information to me to go. So I went. I was not interested as much, but I was upset when I was there because I saw that there were a lot of kids who had lived in the capital, where there hadn't been the war at that time, who were going as candidates for this. So that was very upsetting to me because, first of all, I felt like they didn't really know firsthand the experience to be able to speak about it at an international level if they came to the UN. So I basically talked to the person who was interviewing me about this, how I was upset that they could even consider those candidates, and then I kind of stormed out of the place. But this, then I got selected to go. And so
that fellow knew he had the right kid.
That's how probably he knew that now that's the right kid who was going to say whatever he feels like saying. So I came alongside with another friend of mine, actually, who lives in Canada right now. The two of us came to talk about this issue at the United Nations in 96, and this is how I met my mother now in New York. She was one of the facilitators for this project. She's a storyteller, and so she was brought there to kind of, you know, walk with us and how to, you know, write what we wanted to tell, to present in front of all these ambassadors and UN people.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about your American mother, Laura Sims.
Laura Sims is a storyteller, a professional storyteller. She's very good. Now, I have a very high standard of oral tradition storytelling since I grew up in it. And I was quite taken by her when, you know, during when I met her in 1996, everyone was introducing themselves. I work for UNICEF, I do this. And then she got up and said, I am a storyteller. And I was immediately very thrilled, I mean, not curious, to find out how this, you know, woman who lives in New York, white American, becomes a storyteller. So I wanted to find out. So, you know, then I took her workshop and I became close with her. And also, another kindness that she offered us, myself and my friend who lives in Canada now, was that we had come to this country in the winter of 96, at the end of the year, and we had no winter clothes. No one told us where we were going. Maybe they too didn't know it was winter. And so she went home after she'd seen us and got us winter clothes, hats, and jackets. So because of that, also, we had become close with her, and we became friends a little bit. And so when I went back to Sierra Leone after the conference, she continued writing to me. I would call her, collect, we'll talk, and she sent me money to go to school. Then the capital city also fell to the war, and the entire nation basically collapsed. And so she was worried that I might be dragged again into this war, so she helped get me out.
Yeah. That was in November of 1996. That's when you returned to Sierra Leone, and then in May of
97, yeah,
that's when Freetown erupted into chaos. There was a military coup.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you get out of Sierra Leone?
Well, you know, my mom now had sent me some money, so I was able to go out through Guinea. It was very difficult. I had to take a bus. I had to walk first to some place and then take a bus. And then, you know, it took a whole day to get into Conakry, which is the capital of Guinea, where I was for a month. And then my mom helped get me to South Africa because it was very difficult, into Cape Town, South Africa, because it was very difficult to be in Guinea because the Guinean government didn't want refugees or people from Sierra Leone in the capital. So they were sending people into the countryside where you have no access to phones and nothing, refugee camps. So once you were sent there, basically that was it for you. You know, you will have to be there until the war ended. Mm. And so my mom was worried about that, and so she helped. You know, we knew somebody also who we had met at the conference in 96 who lived in Cape Town. So she got me out into Cape Town, and I lived there, and I tried to apply for a visa. She helped me, but I couldn't get one. But finally, I was able to get one in Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, and then came to the U.S. And, again in 1998, in the summer, June of 98, to live here.
Yeah. Back to 1996, and it's the close of the conference at the UN. And the last day of the conference, a child from each country spoke briefly. Mm-hmm. What did you say?
Well, I said, first of all, I think I started by telling people that, you know, they shouldn't be afraid of me anymore because I have healed from the war and that I'm no longer in that man. But also I spoke about what I had learned after the war, that, you know, we had come to believe that being in the war, after being trolled and traumatized, that we were revenging, we were avenging the death of our family, and that that was the way to do it. But I think what I came to learn during that war, and I, even to this day, is that, you know, the whole idea of revenge does not really help solve the problem, because it just exacerbates it. Because when you go and fight and kill somebody else because of the loss of your family, in that process you kill somebody who has nothing to do with your loss, and they too are brainwashed and picked up and want to revenge. And you have a whole circle of revenge, which only brings more madness. And until somebody stops, there is nothing. And I really came to that understanding right when I got out of the war, because I had met a lot of kids who also got out of the war from the different sides of the war. And they had been told the same rhetoric. They had been told the same hate. The enemy was different. So that's what I spoke about during the conference.
Yeah. Do conferences like that, do they make a difference?
They do, but not at the level of impact that I think some of us came hoping it would. Again, to gather international support and UN to do certain things, it's a process that's not as fast. But what it did, I think that was the time that people began to see that there's a possibility that these children whose lives are touched by it can be healed. Because prior to that, they had not had children who have lived through this and who had been rehabilitated come and speak at a UN level, you know?
Yeah.
So people were still a little uncertain whether children who have been dragged to these manners can actually be helped at all, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that it made it clear. And because of that, I think people in the NGO world were more likely to set up these things and try to help these children, because they have seen the possibility of recovery. And also from that conference, I think, you know, it was when Graça Machel, who was the wife of Nelson Mandela, had done this report, a study on violence on children, and she presented it at that same conference, and we all gave these testimonies, and that led to the creation of a UN office for children in armed conflict, specifically to deal with this issue. So, and that became something that they brought on the Security Council, and so, you know, some improvement got done, but again, it takes a while for, you know, international legal standards or international support behind these things to really grow. It's a very slow process, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us just a little bit about your work as a member of the Children's Rights Division Advisory Committee of Human Rights Watch.
Well, on the Advisory Committee, one of the things that we do, you know, you know, we have people who do research. There are people who are on the ground in different countries where these children are affected by war. So we talked about first how we can do effective advocacy work. Yesterday I was with Joe Becker, who is one of the people on the Human Rights Committee and also works for Human Rights Watch and the Children in Armed Conflict section. And we had a hearing where Senator Durbin and a few others had come up with a bill, and some people supported it yesterday. Well, I testified at a hearing where the bill is basically trying to push for the U.S. government to restrict military aid to nations that recruit children, or those that allow children to be recruited in their territory. And there's research being done to found out that actually the U.S. does give support to 9 countries where children are recruited or these things happen. So, you know, these kinds of stuff we do, advocacy work, and try to find ways to get governments involved to lean weight on others. But we also talk about, you know, the possibility of recovery through advocating on behalf of the creation of, rehabilitation centers. We talked about policy, how we can impact policy in different nations, how we can keep basically doing things to strengthen the laws that are already in place, so that, for example, people who prosecute children are being brought to justice. You know, people who recruit children are being prosecuted, and these kinds of stuff. So we do all stuff from advocacy work to practical things of setting up, helping to raise awareness, setting up rehabilitation centers, to creating policy and so on.
Yeah, very good. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Ishmael, thank you very much for speaking this afternoon with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ishmael Bia has been our guest in this portion of the program. He's the author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And coming up next month, he will be in Chicago to talk about child soldiers. That event will be at the University of Illinois at Chicago on the evening of Thursday, May 3rd, 2007. It will be held in room 302 of the Student Center East at 6 p.m. That's May 3rd, 2007, the University of Illinois at Chicago.